Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Barry Snyder, and I represent the appellant, Eugene Watson. This is a workers' compensation case that involves the displaced worker doctrine and the concept of total disability from work. My client was employed by Walmart in its warehouse and was injured in an accident, which is acknowledged by the employer, on May 15, 2007. He injured his low back and was on total disability for a period of time. He eventually underwent surgery to his low back, replacing a disc. Unfortunately, the surgery did not fix his problem, and he was eventually released from further medical treatment with some significant restrictions given the type of work.
As I understand it, the legal issue before us is very narrow. Your client claimed that he was a displaced worker.
Correct.
There are two ways to establish that. One is to show that he's a prima facie displaced worker, and the other is to show that he made a reasonable search for an alternative job and was turned down because of his disability.
Yes.
As I understand it, the Industrial Accident Board rejected the first prong.
Prima facie case.
What's that? The prima facie case,
yes.
And you're not appealing from that.
Yes, I am.
You are?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought that the sole basis for the appeal was the second prong, that is, the reasonableness of the job search.
I actually, in my argument, raised both issues. That he is prima facie displaced, given his age, educational background, work history, et cetera, and his physical limitation. I believe that he is could be easily characterized as a general laborer, given the fact that he's now 56, but most of his work history was janitorial work, warehouse work, heavy lifting kind
of
things.
Then help me out here. Did the Industrial Accident Board hold that your client had not presented a prima facie case that he was a displaced worker, or that he had, but that the evidence in opposition overcame, that showing?
Their opinion was that he did not present enough evidence to establish prima facie that he was a displaced worker.
Okay.
And similarly, on appeal, the Superior Court made the same finding. And I have argued both in the Superior Court and in this court that he is a displaced worker. I'm not sure at the end of the day it matters, because the employer still has the opportunity to do a job analysis and present evidence, and that's probably the most important part of this case.
Okay, well, I just have one last question. My understanding is that with respect to the second prong, the reasonableness of the job search, that our review standard is basically substantial evidence. It's essentially a fact question.
Correct.
And so the issue was the finding that the job search was unreasonable against the weight of the evidence, however nicely you want to address that up doctrinally. But I'm not sure what our standard of review is on the first issue.
I believe it's the same. It's a fact-driven ruling by the Industrial Accident Board.
All right. Then you're contending that there are some facts that compel or should have compelled both the Industrial Accident Board and the Superior Court to find that Mr. Watson was a prima facie displaced worker.
Yes.
And what are those facts?
He has a high school education and nothing more. He served in the military, but he received no type of training which would be transferable to jobs beyond the military. He only served in the military 2 years back in the 1970s. When you look at his job history, which he testified to at the Industrial Accident Board, he worked as a janitor for many years at Delaware State University. He worked in factories, doing manual labor. He worked for Lear, putting on seat covers, and his most recent job at Walmart in the warehouse was a heavy labor, unloading trucks, putting things on shelves and transferring them back.
Okay, so that's basically a assembly of different facts.
Yes.
And you're contending that as a matter of law, you know, they compel a finding that Mr. Watson was a prima facie displaced worker. On what principle do you rely? On what case do you rely to get there?
There is not a specific case on which I rely. There are many cases that have dealt with the displaced worker concept. And
I mean, aren't you? We're not here to refine the facts.
No, you are not.
So,
but the facts I've just recited are in the record.
No, they may be, but the question is, do they amount to a mandatory finding that your client was a prima facie displaced worker? And if they do, there that has to be based on a principled reason, or there's got to be some authority,
right,
you know, for us to unsettle the finding of fact that was made by the board.
The Ham case, which was the first case that dealt with this concept, and I think there may be one other case that this court has dealt with the concept, did not issue a checklist or any other type of guidance to say this is what you have to do to be a displaced worker. It was, I think, appropriate to leave it up to the court and the Industrial Accident Board to develop the law in this area. And there have been many Superior Court cases. Some go one way, some go the other.
So the answer is you don't have a case.
I do not have a specific case that has these facts that I can say.
Then
this
do you
is
have a legal
like
principle which, when applied to these facts, get you to where you're telling us we need to go?
In a global sense, the principle is Mr. Watson a general laborer? Is that what he is? And if he is, then is he limited in his education and training to being a general laborer? I mean, you could have a PhD and decide to be a general laborer, and then if you get injured, you can go do something else. But that's not this case. This is a case of a high school educated person in his mid-50s, African American, who gets injured, has a bad back, and now, because of the injury, is forced into the labor market and is basically unemployable, given his history. I think that's what makes him prima facie a displaced worker.
Well, finding that he's unemployable kind of puts the rabbit in the hat, doesn't it? I mean, there
I'm not sure
evidence,
I understand that.
There was evidence from the employer that, you know, even with his disability, there were jobs for which he would be suitable and for which that disability wouldn't be a disqualification.
Certainly, the employer, as in all of these cases, hired a vocational rehabilitation expert to do a labor market survey and found that there were jobs that exist that, according to the job description, my client would meet the requirements. But as you get to the second
Those are the facts that were accepted by the board. And why isn't that dispositive?
And I think these two ways to establish total disability are very interrelated.
Let's not relate them yet. Let's talk about the first. Why doesn't, if the board, as I understand it did, accepts the testimony of the employer's expert, then what you have is a finding that notwithstanding Mr. Watson's physical disability, he's still employable.
The argument for the employer is that if we come up with a vocational rehabilitation who identifies jobs, then they win and you don't need to have a hearing. That's not the law. You still have to have a hearing.
Well, he did have a hearing.
He did. But my client did a job search. He applied for 28 jobs in the same time frame that this vocational rehabilitation person did their analysis.
Okay, but that really goes to the second prong, doesn't it?
The other way to prove displaced worker, other than prima facie, is actually a two-pronged test. One, did you do a reasonable job search? And were you rejected for employment because of your disability, work disability? The Industrial Accident Board found against my client on both issues. The Superior Court found that the case was, the decision of the Industrial Accident Board was wrong and could be overruled on the question of whether he couldn't find a job because of his disability, that employers had rejected him because of his disability. So the Superior Court found that prong was met.
Are we now moving into the second
issue? We are.
Okay. Well, I still don't have an answer to my first, you know, question on the first issue, which is why, once we posit that the board accepted the testimony of the industrial expert.
Vocational expert.
Why isn't that dispositive of your first claim?
It is, in the sense that if the evidence establishes that there are jobs out there that he could get, then they would win. Well, but
I think we, from our perspective, and certainly from what I understood from the briefing and so forth, the real argument here has to do with the acceptability of your client's job search.
I agree with that.
Okay, so let's get right to that issue. And my concern on this is, by what standard does the board say this was or was not an adequate job search? Obviously, you could have a set of facts where the claimant made one phone call and the employer had a list of 15 places that had jobs available. And based upon that enormous discrepancy, the board says you didn't make an adequate job search. But once you get past a pretty extreme set of facts, by what standard does the board make its decision?
There is not much guidance for the board in the case law or in the law.
Well,
this whole concept.
And in fact, what the Superior Court said was the board's explanation of its decision on this issue is lacking. And the board's holding is stated in rather conclusory terms with little reasoning included in support. Such summary decision making is troubling, and because it makes the reviewing court's job difficult.
I love that language.
I anticipated that when I read it.
But what I'm trying to find out, because I haven't found it, frankly, is there some objective standard by which you evaluate the validity and acceptability of a job search along the lines of, well, in addition to making phone calls, you have to have submitted resumes. You have to have gone to the location and sat in the waiting room and filled out, or anything that said, here are a variety of things that you must do for it to be a valid job search, and if you only do some of them, then maybe it is, maybe it's not. If you do none of them, clearly it's not. But how does a claimant have any way of knowing what an adequate job search is if there's no standard?
To my knowledge, there is no standard, and so therefore it is difficult. I'm sorry.
But in this case, wasn't there an implicit standard used, you know, whether it's part of general law or not? As I understand it, both the board and the Superior Court were looking to, whether the conduct of your client in searching for a job showed a genuine desire to obtain employment as distinguished from going through the motions.
That is what I think the Superior Court actually went a little further than the Industrial Accident Board by saying that he seemed insincere in his efforts. But that would be an Industrial Accident Board ruling because that's the only body that actually heard and saw my client. Justice Berger posited a one phone call, one attempt versus lots of jobs out there. And I would say probably on the flip side of that, hundreds of applications might be on the other end of the spectrum, and then everything else is in a gray area. I do think that the Superior Court opinion, and let me refer to that, the Superior Court opinion said that my client's job search wasn't thorough, and a couple of things that the judge said was that he didn't observe any of the potential jobs. Well, as a person trying to apply to Dover Downs or any of the other places he applied, you don't get to do that. If you're a vocational rehabilitation expert, you can call Human Resources and come in and look at jobs because you're doing a report. But if you're an employee applying on a computer screen, you don't get to walk in and say, well, let me take a look at what a security guard does or a greeter does. It doesn't work that way in this day and age. You don't get to walk in. The only way you can apply for a lot of these jobs is on the Internet. Fill out an application, you either hear from you or you don't. So I think that's an unfair statement of the Superior Court judge to say you're supposed to go in and look. And then
Snyder, you can continue, but you're into your time you've reserved. So of your reserve time, you have 3.5 minutes. Do you want to stop or continue?
I do also want to point out that he said that my client didn't ask about training or pay. Again, you're on a computer screen. You don't get to ask those questions. The vocational rehabilitation person does. When they're doing the report, they meet with Human Resources, they get these descriptions, and that's all fine. But that puts the playing field well off, too much in favor of the employer, I think. My client applied for a lot of these jobs online. Some of the jobs were the exact jobs that the vocational rehabilitation person identified, and they weren't available to him. Now, he did put on his application, and it was on every application, that he had a limitation, a physical limitation. Whether that was a factor, the Superior Court judge said, yes, apparently it was, and I would say that it was. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. May it please the Court, my name is Christine O'Connor, and I represent Walmart in this matter. I had what I thought was a fairly eloquent opening to offer you today, but it sounds like you want to get right to the point as to what is at issue. From the employer's perspective, we do not think that the prima facie displaced worker argument is on the table today. That, if you look at Mr. Snyder's brief, was raised in the questions presented. If you actually turn to his argument question, it focuses on the second test, the job search test. But I'd be happy to entertain questions if you would like to discuss the prima facie displaced worker.
I'd like to discuss the job search situation. I realize, you know, you're not the board. You're the employer. So to some extent, I don't know that you can answer these questions. But do you understand that there is any standard by which the board is to make its decision as to whether a job search was reasonable or not?
Well, I don't think, and I agree with Mr. Snyder, that there is an established standard. There isn't a list of rules that we can check off as claimants testify in these matters. What I can glean from the case law is, in the extreme situation that you've offered, one contact, maybe a follow-up phone call, that's unreasonable. However, there is a case cited, I believe, by the claimant, the Adams case, wherein the board found that 234 job offer letters generated by the attorney's office on behalf of the injured worker was also unreasonable. That was manufactured in anticipation of litigation. So it's not really a numbers thing. I think what the board is looking at, and you know, the word reasonable is the most confounding word and confounding concept in law, in my opinion. What the board is looking at is each case on the fact, what did this person do? In this case, we have a gentleman who did a job search. 28 jobs were identified. Almost half of them were outside of his restrictions. I think what the board, standard-wise, is looking for, number one, did
you... Well, wait a second. 28 divided by 2 is 14, right?
Right.
Which is more than what your expert was able to come up with, right?
That is true.
So even, you know, as opposed to the fact that half of them were outside of his restriction and therefore don't really represent some valid search, maybe if anything, that's evidence that there weren't enough jobs within his limitations to even look at.
Well, here's the thing on the other side, the employer's side too. There isn't anything in the law that says the employer's expert has to identify a certain number of jobs.
Okay, so, and bear with me on this.
Sure.
What I'm getting from my understanding of the case law and the board's various decisions is a claimant comes along and the employer is saying this person can go back to work now. Claimant says, no, I can't find any work. And the board says, I don't think you're really looking. I think you're happy just staying at home. So whatever you come in and say you've done, it's not enough because there wasn't enthusiasm behind it, or there wasn't a real effort to obtain the jobs. It was just going through the motions, and I'm concerned about a body making its decision that way, because you then have a problem with making a credibility determination without any basis to make it. If you understand that, you know, if a witness comes and stammers and is evasive in answering questions or gives inconsistent answers, there's a whole bunch of reasons why a fact finder could find that person not credible. But if a person comes along and they're not very eloquent, but they explain that I checked here, how can the fact finder say, well, you know, but you didn't really try?
I think you have to weigh more things in the balance other than enthusiasm. I understand what you're saying. How can we ever judge each other's, you know, way we do things? In this case, Mr. Watson came in and presented a list of the jobs that he identified over time. He indicated that he either applied online or in person. He did the best he could. He admitted that he unveiled his restrictions when asked. The board, though, also took into consideration that he really didn't do anything more than that. There wasn't any testimony about follow-up calls where he could.
Did they ever say that, or is that something the Superior Court just inferred was important from the record? The employer made that argument, and so we've talked about the employer's perspective, the employee's perspective, but we need to also think about the court's perspective if we're going to review these. And quite frankly, what's troubling about this case is if we narrow the issues to the ones you've identified, what was the job search? And assuming it was adequate, and did the denial of success, lack of success, is it attributable to your disability? And what the board said is, to the extent you applied for jobs and got no answer or a couple of rejections, the Superior Court said the board got that wrong. So we know at least on half of the legal equation, the Superior Court said the board was wrong. But then the board said, well, that doesn't make any difference because you never conducted an adequate search to begin with. But then if we go back to the part of the opinion I just read, the Superior Court starts out by saying, you've simply listened to what the claimant said, and the board has announced that's not good enough. And the Superior Court said, that's a little troubling, because now I have to fill in the blanks on why it wasn't good enough. So the reason this is a troubling appellate record to review is because no one identified any standards or applied them to these facts.
I'll agree with you in the written board decision. That is the case. There was very little said about what made this gentleman's job, quote-unquote, unreasonable. But there was enough in the record, and I think the Superior Court recognized that. The record as a whole, the transcript, the demeanor of the claimant and whatnot, that the decision about the job search being unreasonable was sufficient.
All right, but let me go back and tell you, as an objective reader of this record, I think reasonable minds could have disagreed. And that's why we have standards of appellate review. And because if you articulate the reason why the job search was inadequate, the standard of appellate review is pretty deferential. If it could come out one of two ways, the trier of fact picks one, they get a lot of deference. The problem here is, you'll have to just call it a hypothetical if you want. I think reasonable minds could have differed. So the absence of an explanation from the board makes it hard to review on appeal.
I think where the focus gets lost is that there was testimony from a vocational expert that said there are jobs out there. We did consider the restrictions. Part of Mr. Watson's problem was he applied for many jobs that were already not, you know, within his realm of physical capability.
But don't you think Mr. Watson's reaction to that would be, give me the seven people, I'll go apply? It's one thing, you know, is what we're hearing from Mr. Snyder, to say in the abstract, theoretically, there are jobs there. And what Mr. Watson is saying, I really applied for 28, and I didn't get any. And if I'd have known about these seven, I might have added them to my list. But how do we reconcile that conflict between theoretically you could find a job with the fact that you searched for 28 and you struck out?
I think that it's hard to reconcile that. We should not, in this case, consider 28. We should consider the 16 that were determined to be within his restrictions. And part of the
employer... We're happy to do that. 16. I won't say 28 again.
I thought it was 14. But
we'll even go with 14.
Well, the two that he received written rejections for were already out of the gate beyond what he could do. Part of the problem in this case is that, A, this gentleman started when litigation began. There was no motivation from when he was released to return to work to start. That's a reasonableness problem right there. It's not reasonable to wait when your doctor has released you, and all of a sudden you have to start looking for work when somebody tells you to. Number two, you
really?
Can't.
I thought we said you didn't have to go to work if your doctor says you were restricted.
Well, in 2008, November, I believe Dr. Fisher released Mr. Watson to return to work with restrictions, and Dr. Keene, the employer's witness, also agreed with the restrictions. Mr. Watson didn't start his job search until February of 2009. Mm-hmm. The petition was filed, I believe, in December, so there was a sort of a late start out of the gate.
So wait a second. Let's assume for the moment that the court wants to set forth some standards so that everybody knows where we're coming from. Because the whole displaced worker doctrine is a court doctrine, right?
Yes.
Okay, so let's say we want to work with it a little bit. You're saying that part of what makes a job search unreasonable is waiting until some period of time, until after a petition has been filed to terminate your benefits, to begin the job search. That is evidence that it's an unreasonable job search.
Yes, and the courts have found that in other cases, the Miranda case, which I cited as well, also found that the job search was unreasonable because the injured worker in that matter also waited until litigation to begin her search.
Okay. Are there any cases where the board found that there was a reasonable job search?
Yes.
And what had the claimant done in those cases?
Well, the ones that we cited were, it was actually difficult to glean what the board said in those cases. But again, this whole equation is made up of parts. The timing of the search, the type of search, the effort put into the search. In this case, you know, one of the main arguments from the employer is that the court and the board should not read a rejection because of injury into a non-response. I think that's a huge issue in this case. Many of the jobs for which the claimant was qualified in this case didn't respond. We don't know why.
What was the claimant supposed to do?
Well, I don't have a good answer for that, and I thought about that all the way down here.
but isn't that pretty telling? If you don't have an answer for that, it means that, and you're a well-educated person, a professional, it means that it's not clear to the average claimant what needs to be done beyond actually applying and being honest with the prospective employer. I don't see any reason why you have to, you know, go out and do things to show you're enthusiastic about it in order to make it reasonable. What kind of standards can be imposed that everybody can understand they have to live by?
Well, I think if I knew that, I'd be a legislator or a judge.
Well, let's try this on for size.
Sure.
I think everybody agrees that an economic matter, as a policy matter, what this doctrine of displaced workers is driving at is whether the market, that is the employment market, has any room for this particular claimant given his or her disabilities. And in order to determine the answer to that, the reasonable job search doctrine or requirement has been imposed. So the question is, what really constitutes a bona fide test of the market so that, any fact finder can be assured that the market really does or does not have a place for this particular claimant. Now, the problem with putting it that way is that it means that either a court has got to derive or reduce that, that big idea to a legal standard, or conclude that it's a matter of fact and require expert testimony on the issue of what a reliable market test would be in each case.
You mean expert testimony on the claimant side?
Yes.
Well, I agree with you. It seems to seems to suggest that that would be needed. However, the courts have said that the claimant does not need to bring in corroborating evidence to establish his reasonable job search. It's all done on his or her testimony.
Okay, maybe the plaintiff doesn't, but my question and I think you isolated the problem, somebody has to. That is, the board needs guidance from somebody, and if what is a bona fide search of the employment market varies from case to case, then somebody needs to put on an expert so that the board has got some basis.
Agreed.
To make a determination.
In the case of Jennings versus University of Delaware, which was decided in 1986, that's the case that outlines exactly the standard that the employer's vocational expert has to follow in order to establish availability of work and the proper job search that we offer as the employer to substantiate the fact that, when we argue that someone's not totally disabled, the evidence...
Tell me how, given that case and these facts, tell me your understanding of how the law operates or what the standard is. We have a situation where the claimant said, I looked for 14 jobs unsuccessfully. We all agree they were contenders. And he just didn't get a job. Then the employer comes in and says, well, we found 7 possibilities. How do you reconcile that to come up with a conclusion that the claimant's job search was unreasonable?
Well, there's nothing in the law that says the vocational expert has to come in with a certain number of jobs.
No, just say one job. I could see if the vocational expert came in with 250 jobs, and then you'd say, well, gee, there are plenty of jobs out there. You shouldn't have quit at 14. You should have kept going. But in this particular case, where we're trying to come up with a standard that we can apply to different factual situations, you have a situation where a person says, I legitimately looked for 14 jobs I was qualified for unsuccessfully. And the employer's expert says, well, we found 7 that you might have found and maybe you were qualified for. But then the board has to say, was the search for the 14 jobs, a good search?
In this case, the board understood from the testimony that even some of the jobs Mr. Watson took from the vocational expert, by the time he did that, some of the jobs or the employers weren't hiring. So there's that problem.
Well, and I would like to follow up on that problem. To what extent does the reasonableness of a job search and arguably even somebody's being a prima facie displaced worker relate to the economy. I mean, there are people who've worked their whole lives and don't have any disability that are out of work and are looking for work. Shouldn't that be a factor that the board has to consider in evaluating his eligibility, either as a displaced worker or the adequacy of his job search?
In fact, one of the cases that I have here, and for some reason I can't put my finger on it right now, the courts have specifically indicated that the economy does not factor in. The economy is not to be taken into consideration in these types of cases.
That's a Delaware decision?
Yes, Your Honor. It's age, physical restrictions, vocational background, educational background. This is a gentleman who was high school educated, had worked in a number of environments, all the way up to a supervisory position. He had been employed all of his life. Up until recently, you know, he was the age he is now or close to it. The economy is what the economy is, but in the context of an IAB hearing, this gentleman only did a very limited amount to find work. He didn't talk to anybody. He didn't attempt to determine what the physical restrictions of these jobs were. He admitted candidly that he actually pursued positions that were well beyond his restrictions.
But we're told that the only access to information that Mr. Watson had was to apply online. How is he realistically supposed to get to do what you say he should have done?
Some of the jobs in this case were only accessible via online applications. If you recall his testimony, he did apply in person to some positions. He inquired through friends, I believe, about the TV moving position. This gentleman didn't even ask what these jobs paid. I think the board concluded that he just sort of went out, did what his attorney told him to, after a petition was filed, and submitted a list of jobs.
I'm having some trouble with this. And by the way, I would like you to get me the name of that case. You don't have to do it right now, but I'm troubled in the sense that not asking how much the job paid was apparently something used against this claimant, whereas from my perspective, if I want a job, I don't want to sound as if it matters to me how much you're going to pay me. I just want to get in the door and get the job. And if you tell me you're not paying me much, then you know, if I have a better choice, I'll go elsewhere, but at least I'll have gotten this job. And yet that was used against him. So it befuddles me as to how the reasonableness of a job search can be determined.
Your Honor, I'm out of time. May I?
Go ahead.
Well, again, the Superior Court actually focused on this issue in a big way, I think. It's the motive. You know, there's a lot that hangs in the balance with this, you know, whether or not the search is reasonable. But the motive in this case, the board saw a gentleman who did make a search. It was sort of half-hearted, and I think that came through in the board's decision and the Superior Court decision. Sincerity and credibility, again, in the Miranda case, very much focused upon by the courts. It's just one of the many factors, again, that goes into the balance, and there may never be a very clear standard on this. I know there's a clear standard on the employer's side, but there may never be a clear standard on the employee's side. But for Your Honor's sake, the case which I refer to is the Hawks versus Radisson Wilmington Hotel about the economy. That's citing Harrison versus Deemer Steel Casting Company.
What's the site on Hawks?
Hawks is it's an unreported case. It's Westlaw 188990.
What is it? Westlaw?
It's a 1985 decision, Westlaw 188990.
Thank you. What court was that?
That was the Superior Court.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Sometimes we know that when you're defending something on appeal, you wish you'd gotten more help from those people that ruled in your favor.
Thank you.
That was strictly an observation I was making.
I understand. You have clearly identified what the basis of our appeal is, that I believe my client did a reasonable job search. and he established that when he testified. And the Superior Court, when it upheld the Industrial Accident Board, seemed to read a lot of into the record, which simply wasn't either wasn't there or certainly wasn't in the opinion, that he was half-hearted or did this or didn't do that. I think the Superior Court went further than it should have, and its comment at the beginning was telling that the record was very limited.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.